Hey everyone, welcome into the Woj Pod. I'm here in Denver with my guest, Nuggets President of Basketball Operations, Tim Connolly. We talk about the Nuggets and about their great young star, Nikola Jokic, but we also talk about the life and job of a top NBA executive, how trades and deals are made, and what outside factors Tim thinks often now make GMs hesitant to do deals. We talk about that and a lot more all around the league with Denver Nuggets President of Basketball Operations, Tim Connolly. Here we go. Here with Tim Connolly, President of the Denver Nuggets. Tim, how are you, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I like the view here from your office, Chopper Place in Denver, of the Six Flags Amusement Park, which is a rare downtown water slide.
I have first, you got to correct President of Basketball Operations. I think
Josh
get in trouble. Yeah, I look at the water slides all the time.
Did you get new business cards for that this year?
I do not.
Are you still using the GM?
I do know business cards. Yes, the business cards are neat. It's kind of I feel like an idiot when I say, "Well, no, what is your title?" And I kind of quietly say it.
So when you're in here working, like kids are out there going up and down the slides.
Yeah, I can tell you almost to the second how long it will take you to get on the water slides, depending on what step you are on the kind of the tower. It's really neat. It's beautiful too. You have the mountains in the background, but during the summer, that place is packed, and my easiest view is of the water park. So it definitely livens up the day a little bit and makes you wish you were a kid again.
Yeah, there's always that feeling some of us get around, you know, free agency, July 2nd, 3rd, 4th, when everyone else in the world is barbecuing there at the beach and you're grinding through deals and, right, you're longing to just go take a run down the water slide, right?
And wives always really understand that, right? It's not 4th of July, New Year's Eve, Christmas, you know, all those holidays don't really matter, but, you know, we have very good Augusts. it's funny. When you're in these, you spend a lot of long hours, and thankfully our job is really enjoyable, so there's no bad days, but certainly when you see that place packed, you think about other places you might want to be right now.
Where did you go as a kid with seven brothers and sisters? What was a Connolly family vacation like? What were the amusement parks in
the amusement parks was generally Hershey Park.
Oh yeah,
with the Comet, the old wood coaster, and King's Dominion if we were really going all out. Those were our two amusement parks. Ocean City, Maryland, and then we also, you know, we would rent a 15-person van and just drive north, drive to Prince Edward's Island or Nova Scotia or all over New England. You know, so when everyone else was going elsewhere, we were finding these. Hey, we're staying at their normal house. You know? So it was fun, getting on the road and seeing the Northeast and seeing Eastern Canada. It was really fun.
Like, how many hotel rooms are the Connollys?
Probably two. And, you know, the age disparity was enough that I think probably only twice or three times we had all seven. You know, it gets to some point where my older brothers and sisters are like, this isn't cool anymore. I'm, you know, 22, I'm not getting in the last row of the van. But two rooms usually did it.
Yeah. And, well, I remember, like, we had the station wagon, right? And back, nobody was wearing
backward facing station wagon?
Yeah, in the back.
I think that's why I still get car sick, facing backwards in the the worst, the absolute worst.
Right, right, yeah. Tim, your camp with the Nuggets now, you haven't had this kind of depth and talent and decisions to be made. I mean, you've got good young players like Malik Beasley who you're trying to figure out where do you find minutes for him. It's a good problem to have. It's a problem you have to have in the West if you're going to compete.
Right? Yeah, we're fortunate that a lot of the guys that we've picked, the coach has done a great job developing them, and we have a locker room full of guys that can play rotation minutes. Certainly that's not going to be the case. You can't play all 15 guys and now all 17 guys with the two-way guys, but it's going to be a challenge. I think we want guys that are certainly capable of producing and unhappy when they're not playing, but we also want guys to know that professionalism has to be put in front of everything, and we have a pretty high and lofty team expectation this year. But it's the neat thing is to see guys pushing each other. See a guy, you mentioned Malik, come back last year. I'm sorry, after the summer, a better player. I mean, he was in the gym all the time. And neat story with Malik. He landed from a NBA camp in China on draft night and came right from the airport to the gym to work out with Jamal. So that type of work ethic, you can't teach. I think our young guys all kind of embody that approach. So it's fun. It's been extremely competitive and no one's taking anything for granted, and certainly if you're not producing, there's someone behind you that can.
You talked about having your guys in the gym all summer and having players around, and you see that more and more with organizations where, you know, at least by September, everybody's back, and a lot of places they stay through the summer. From when you got into the league in Washington and were with different organizations and even with no players and see how guys worked, is it different in the league now? Is it more of a 12-month-a-year job? Do players treat it differently now than even when you got in the league of how competitive they are in preparation and putting the work in the summers?
Yeah, I think with the advances in training, the guys have become a lot more learning and how to approach their body full-time. I think when I got in the NBA, there was great players that you wouldn't see until September. They pick up a ball and they show up at training camp 9 pounds heavy, and by the first regular season game, they were back to being stars again. I think with the present NBA, that's not the case. These guys will take 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off. I think at times, quite frankly, you can almost overtrain, not just physically but mentally. It's become such a nonstop grind. We always try to get our guys away from it a little bit. There's a line where you're doing the same thing over and over and over. It becomes repetitive. You kind of lose the creativity and a bit of the challenge of it. But now these guys are all, I mean, we have 19, 20, 21-year-old guys that have nutritionists and eat perfect. And when I, 96, 97, I was in the league, the best players were having 6 beers and wings after a game, you know, sometimes before a game. So I think it's become with modern medicine becoming better, and certainly we have a bunch of really creative trainers and strength coaches and performance specialists, it's become a 12-month job, and these guys really treat their bodies as temples, and that wasn't the case when I got in the league.
How do you learn to judge, like, whether it's medical staff, nutritionists? How do you become, like, from a basketball executive to an expert in these scientific areas that you have no background in, but you've got to hire people, you've got to make decisions on what's the right course of action for your group? How do you learn that?
It's really challenging, and I don't think you do. I think you have to hire the right people and do as much background as you can on who you're going to put in those positions and then trust them. I've seen it at times where a front office executive, you know, you can think you know these things, and I didn't go to school for anything. I'm not a PT. I'm not a head athletic trainer. I'm not a surgeon. So I think all you can do is surround yourself with bright people and let them do their jobs. But it's challenging because it's the one area that is unbelievably impactful that I have no background in. I was not a good student in science or math. So to have these conversations and you're talking to these really bright doctors, and it can be especially challenging when you have two or three opinions. And in my head, I'm saying, all these doctors are great. This guy just operated on this guy. This other guy has $1 billion of knees on his walls of pictures of guys he's done the operations. So that part can be really challenging when, to me, I'm like, God, they both look like fantastic doctors. And I certainly don't have a loud voice, but that's where we're lucky. We have a great medical staff, and those guys ensure we make limited mistakes, because it's so much of a crapshoot, but there are just so many smart people in that field right now. It can almost be sensory overload and almost paralysis by analysis, but it's challenging for sure. And if you don't have good people running those departments, it can be a real issue.
And like the way it's competitive and you trying to hire assistant coaches and get guys, or hiring front office executives or scouts, that area has become competitive too, of who's, like, guys are building reputations out there. What organization's getting them, hiring them? That's become a more, like, those salaries have gone up. They become more in demand.
Right? Yeah, it's an arms race in that area. It's because it's something that has a direct effect on how many healthy games you have. And there's nothing more important than availability, even over skill set. I think there is a fascinating debate now, too. We are getting so good medically. I think we're extending careers oftentimes, but are we extending careers but potentially limiting the impact of the present team? You know, are the guys – you don't see many guys playing 82 anymore. And, you know, if 15 years ago, it was commonplace for a ton of guys to play 80, 82 games. So now, as science gets better, we're smartly resting these guys and picking their spots and extending careers. Organizationally, are you missing some of the meat a little bit? Extending careers, essentially, but are you leaving some on the table on the back end? With the player. It's kind of fascinating. I debate with our medical staff all the time in that regard. It's just, it's so much right now, so much information. We have blood draws and obviously monitor their loads. It can really get to a point, like fellas, are we in shape or are we not in shape? Is he healthy or is he not healthy? And that's when, again, if you don't have the right people in kind of informing you of how to get through all this, these mounds of information, if you don't have the right guys who can translate the information, because ultimately, as a coach or as a front office, you just want to, is the guy healthy? Can he play? And it's a really neat time in that field, but it's also a curious time because it's become such a huge cottage industry.
The league cutting back on back-to-backs, extending the season by starting it earlier, and then, you know, this conversation now about 82 games. Does the weight of that feel like an issue for you, for your organization? Is it different with a younger team? Should this be as big of a conversation as it's become?
Well, for us, you know, we don't have any extremely close cities. So for us, the more time in the schedule, the better. Because oftentimes, you know, we have a pretty big home court advantage because of the altitude. And most people are flying here after two-hour flights at least. On the flip side, us in Portland in particular, we're also don't have, like when I was in D.C., you get to Philadelphia and X amount of time, you could train to Philly, you're in 20 cities with an hour and 10 minutes in air. It makes the travel much easier. So I think it does benefit us. I think it's well-intentioned. I think the league has listened to a lot of the team's concerns and the players' concerns. But internally, we don't want to ever be a team that uses anything as a crutch. I mean, we're going to play whoever's in front of us. We want guys to be mentally and physically prepared to play 82 games. It can become a bit self-fulfilling, you know. Oh, back-to-back. And sometimes, like, back-to-back, you're 21 years old. Just because you've heard of back-to-back's tough your whole life. And these guys, a lot of these guys, almost their whole team came up in the AAU culture. They're playing four or five games a day. So it is certainly a factor, and I think the league has done a good job of extending the schedule and hopefully see more quality games, less guys resting just to rest. But, you know, we want to be a team that doesn't look at the schedule and use it as any type of excuse.
It's hard to win any night in the NBA, but do you factor in, based on scheduling, that the altitude is worth a couple victories a year? Do you feel like there's teams who just come in and just looks like they're running underwater based on four games and five nights and then coming into the air?
We've done a good job the last couple of years regaining the sense of home court advantage. The year before I got here, Coach Carl and Masai Singh, they were 38-3 at home, I think. So there's historical indicators that we have to do a better job at home court. I think we started to do that last year. The altitude's hard. I mean, I'm terribly out of shape, so I'm a bad person to talk about anything with fitness. But if I leave for a week and come back and try to play basketball, the first 8 minutes is really hard. So with the way we play, with the pace at which we want to play and the way we move the ball, certainly altitude is part of our approach. But it's hard. If you come in here, especially the west to east set doubleheaders, I'm sorry, back-to-backs, it's really difficult. You get in at 3 o'clock, you get in your hotel at 3:30, and then you'll feel the altitude for sure. And it's something that if you can get through it, you can get through it. But the first quarters is not easy. It's not easy for us when we're on a long road trip. It's something you can't hide from and something that we try to use to our advantage as much as possible.
Yeah, my favorite altitude story, when I was covering Jerry Tarkanian at Fresno State, and they had that Colorado State-Wyoming road trip, mm-hmm. Fort Collins, Laramie, and they had gotten drilled in the first part of that. And I remember Tark, they had the day off and then they were going to Laramie. And I remember him having the team before practice and the day in between saying to the team, I don't want to hear any more about the altitude. It will not affect us because the games are played inside. If they were outdoors, the altitude would be a problem. The game's inside. You're not going to feel it. And like everybody, the team kind of looked at each other and shrugged and said, oh, okay, that's makes, you know. Yeah. To this day, story. I'm not sure whether Tark believed that or if he, but he tried to sell his guys on indoor, no altitude indoors. Tim, when you look at, you've got your big board behind you here of the teams, and every GM has this in their office, and you look at rosters and lineups. When you look at the West this year and all your years in the league, have you ever seen anything like this? The moves you've made, bringing in Paul Millsap, Jokic, you know, taking that next step into hopefully becoming a star in this league, and you're a team that's still going to be fighting to make the playoffs in the West.
It can be a bit intimidating, but it's also pretty exciting. As a, you know, ultimately, I'm a fan, so to me, I can't wait. If you look at our division, I mean, it's Jimmy Butler, Karl-Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, CJ McCollum, Damian Lillard, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony, Russell Westbrook, Rudy Gobert. It's a lot of really, really, really good players. So the best way to see where you stand is to compete against the best. We're going to do that within our division, not just our conference, against a lot of guys who are going to end up in Springfield. I've never seen the league so one conference dominant in terms of elite players. I think that's, you know, oftentimes one conference clearly is better. But I can't remember in my 20 years, 21 years, whatever it may be, where there's, if you're ranking the top 20 players in the league, how many are in the West? I mean, there's obviously great, great players in the East. LeBron is still, you know, he's in a class all by himself. And it was so fun to watch the jump that John Wall's made the last couple of years. So it's not like there's slouches in the East. It's just collectively, if you're sitting around having a beer and say, let's rank players, a lot of those names would be in the Western Conference. And it's something that I think I've never seen. And I don't know if the league's ever been this kind of one conference dominant with the top level talent.
You've been aggressive the last couple of years in trying to be a part of some big deals and bring in impact players here. You know, you get closer on some than others. Paul Millsap was a guy who you didn't just start targeting in this free agency, back free agency 4 years ago, a trade that kind of got pretty close a couple of years ago. As much as anybody, he'd been on that list.
Yeah, he's a guy that we've long targeted. We thought the way he plays fit with our team seamlessly. We think the type of person he is, you know, getting to know him now, we've confirmed that, but you do a lot of research and you hear about an egoless guy, a guy who practices, plays, lead by example guy, a guy that made the hard way second round pick and slowly developed into one of the elite players in the NBA. So he's a guy that we've had long circled. So it was pretty exciting this summer for us to finally get a guy like that to commit to our program. And it wasn't just the guy, but it was the guy we wanted, which made it, you know, even more special.
To make a jump in the West, and you see Oklahoma City, there's risk involved. You're going to trade assets for players who you may or may not be able to re-sign. If you're going to chase Golden State in the West, if you're going to chase San Antonio, some of the decisions you made to go after guys, whether it was a Blake Griffin, a Kevin Love, potential deals that I can say you talked about. I don't think you can say it, but there has to be a belief, I guess, within an organization that we can get a guy here and convince him that he'll want to stay here. Because you're not trading him, these guys, to just have them as rentals for a year or two. Does an organization have to get to a certain point before you believe we have enough here to convince a guy to stay? Or are you willing to take, kind of roll those dice at any point?
I think we're in a place now where with the Kroenke family, with Coach Malone, with his staff is fantastic. We have what I think is a pretty impressive front office staff. We're confident if you get within our building, you're going to like it here. I think you're going to be treated fairly. You're always going to be communicated with. We're a pretty direct organization. We don't have a problem having difficult conversations. And we've had not a lot of on-court success, certainly not anywhere near where we should be. But if you talk to guys in our locker room or guys have since left here, I'd like to think that they've enjoyed their experiences. We're straight shooters. We don't take ourselves too seriously. And I think if you're not your own biggest fan, then you take almost an inherent defeatist attitude into every potential deal, and you'll be so risk-averse and deal-averse that I think you'll be stuck in neutral. I think I give Oklahoma City a ton of credit, and they're one of the best programs in the league. So they've roll the dice to some degree with the guys in impending free agency. But they roll the dice knowing that we have a program that's proven to be successful. The guys like it. They enjoy being there. So I think the approach that they took is one similar that we've kicked the tires on a lot of things, not being scared of those type of situations. Because look, if we get you in our building and have you for a year and you don't want to be here, then there's something we probably did wrong. Now, at times there are extenuating circumstances. If it's some guy's dream to play next this market or that market, then so be it. But we feel pretty confident if you come to Denver, you won't just like the organization. The city right now is so vibrant; it's growing at an insane pace right now. And we've had a couple guys who were not excited to come here via trades, and then give us a chance. And 2 months, 3 months later, they love it here.
What if hiring could be easier, more streamlined, and less time-consuming? So even when you're busy, you could still be smart about the way you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates, so you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Woj, W-O-J. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. When you become a GM in this league, you know, that jump from assistant GM to running an organization and all the things you're responsible for, what did you underestimate when you look back at it? What were you not as ready for than you would have imagined?
I think the medical piece is intimidating because basketball, we're not architects. It's not a, you know, we're not engineers. There's no right or wrong in basketball, essentially. I can like player X as long as you have a good rationale behind it, as long as you worked hard to develop that opinion. You're not necessarily right or wrong. And so much of basketball is environmental. Right? If the guy has an opportunity to play or he has a chance to become a bigger piece of the team, he does great. There's really talented guys who don't have the opportunity later in the career. And so the basketball thing is kind of – there's a lot of gray area in the basketball thing. The medical thing, there's not – much gray area. When I got here, we were dealing with a pretty atypical ACL injury with Danilo Gallinari. Mm-hmm. And again, I can read till I'm blue in the face. I didn't go to med school. So that part for sure. I also think, you know, the relationships become different. I thought I knew everyone in the NBA prior to getting this job, but 35% of the NBA didn't know me, if that makes sense. You know, then those relationships become a bit more real and they take on more substance and they don't always end as well as it's, you know, you're the backup quarterbacks at CGM. You know, you can have your opinion. And I was fortunate to work for Dell, a guy that was, without him, I'm certainly not here, but gave me so much leeway. But at the end of the day, I said, all right, Dell, this is what I would do. Enjoy the conversation with the agent. I'm going to take my wife to dinner, you know, and you can't be that guy anymore. So I think the medical piece and just how many decisions you have to make outside of the basketball sphere. I mean, we're, in our basketball operations department, we have over 50 employees. So that's 50 contracts, you know, every couple of years. There's attrition, both positive, you know, guys get better jobs. You allow them the opportunity to better themselves. How do you fill those roles? So I think the non-basketball things were the things that were certainly most overwhelming initially. The basketball is the basketball. And again, you work hard. You know these guys inside and out. And then you make an opinion. And you make a decision ultimately, but you do so knowing that, you know, oftentimes you're going to be wrong. Oftentimes there are going to be environmental issues that it could be the right player, wrong time. But the off the court stuff is, it's nonstop and it's something certainly that I was unaware of just how many decisions had to be made in those areas.
You mentioned staff, and what's your responsibility to the guys who work for you to advance their careers, to expose them to everything? Arturis Karnisovas, who has been a GM candidate some other places, Brooklyn, and then Milwaukee was a finalist there this year. You guys promoted him to general manager. You went to president. And you've had other people come and move on and then move up here. But, like, do you take that on as a burden that I've got to – I owe it to these guys and their careers to – whether it's going to be here or somewhere else to keep them moving?
It's one of the only things that I think we can control. If you hire good people and you allow them to grow internally and there's some great opportunity outside these walls, I think we push them. I would not be here without having those relationships, without working for guys who allowed me to grow. And then certainly allow me ultimately to leave organizations for better jobs. You know, it wouldn't happen without Ernie and Tommy in D.C. and those guys allow me to go to New Orleans. If Josh calls Dell and if there's any indecision there, I'm not here as we speak. But I think it's something that we make a huge point of emphasis on, and it's a great feeling when someone either promote within or someone is recognized and ends up elsewhere. It happened a couple months ago with Chuck Hayes. You know, Chuck came here essentially a paid internship, very little money, lived apart from his family, and Houston wisely targeted him as a guy they wanted in within their front office. You know, bigger role, more money, and it was awesome. It was sad because it was a really good employee, really good friend. But to see a guy like that, his family doesn't have to move. He kind of quickly has moved up the professional ladder. I think that stuff is invaluable. We have certain challenges with our staff, like everyone else does. We're a pretty small staff. But we're a staff that also, if you're going to come here, you're going to do everything. You're not going to be in a box. You're not going to be not privy to conversations. You're not going to read about a move on TV. You're not going to be on the road and not be up to speed with where we are as a team. And I think having the kind of unique perspective of having every job in the front office side, you know, worked in the video room, you worked for the Mystics, you know, had a lot of these jobs. It is frustrating when you don't feel like you're in the know. And if it's also can be really challenging to progress if you're not in an environment that allows you to exist outside of a box. And that's something that we put a huge emphasis on. We've had a lot of really bright guys here, and I think it's fun to be challenged by those guys, and it's fun. If we could create a tree, for lack of a more creative term, I think that'd be one of our, after obvious on-court success, that'd be one legacy that we'd really be proud of.
You talk about having staff, and I remember when you started in your first, you were hired in Denver, Masai had gone to Toronto, and you'd come from New Orleans, and leading up to the draft, your first draft, and then into free agency, you were almost flying solo here. What was that like? Who was in the room?
Well, when I got, it was a tough timing. And again, thankfully, New Orleans was nice enough to allow me to leave. I think, 8 days before the draft. We were knee deep in a coaching search. And then on draft night, it was myself, Herb Livesey, and Ben Tenzer. Ben was fresh out of law school. Herb has years and years of really high level basketball knowledge. You know, my draft board was an Excel sheet. Really, it was an Excel sheet. I mean, it was not something I want to repeat for sure. We got thrown to the fire, and it was it was a tough time of year. You couldn't get staff, and Masai had a great opportunity, and he took a couple of really bright guys with him. You know, Pete had a great opportunity, so it was a pretty bare bones staff.
Pete D'Alessandro,
Pete went to SAC.
SAC, right.
Mike Bratz went to SAC.
Right.
Masai took Dan. He was, a really bright guy, Tolsman. So it was not a typical draft room, I'll say that.
So for people who don't understand, when you have a staff, it's hard for one person to try to communicate with 29 other teams and agents and conversations internally you're having. You just need people on the phone gathering information, bringing you things. And when you don't have that, what happens?
That was probably the most challenging thing of the draft. Again, selecting players, I was intimately involved in that process. I felt we knew the draft fairly well. But not having the back and forth, but not having the intel that you say, hey, I just talked to so-and-so in Philly and they're doing this. Or it was a pretty laughable room in that regard because even trying to get someone on the phone is kind of time consuming, and if it's just you. So again, happy there's no cameras in that room. It was not one of our prouder moments. I think we got through it, and it was really a fun evening, but it was not the draft room that I was accustomed to.
Your background too, like there's probably when things become makeshift, your career hasn't been, like you said, you worked in the WNBA as you were like a college kid who wrote letters to people and got a break and went to Washington. There's probably something to that of trying to figure it out as you go because your jobs were, I don't know if there's a customary way to rise up anymore. You've come from a scouting background. There's lots of different avenues anymore. But did that background prepare you for, all right, this isn't ideal, but I will make it work?
having all these jobs, I always told myself, if I'm ever lucky enough to advance again, my goal was not to be a GM. I wanted to be a director of player personnel. To me, that's the lead bird dog scout. It sounds like a really cool job. You know, this is the guy you come back and say, I just saw this kid in Brazil we got to look at. That was my dream. And somehow a bunch of people, usually smart people who were dumb, gave me these better jobs, and I was able to progress. I told myself I was never going to take it that seriously, because I think there's 30 of teams in the NBA, 16 are successful, right? So the odds are pretty good off the bat. There's only 400 and some NBA players. Of those 400, how many are impactful? So I promised myself that if I ever was in that seat, I didn't want to treat it as if I was a nuclear engineer. It is daunting when it's your final say. You beat yourself up when you do something, and then months later, you're like, God, you know, I really messed that one up. But I think if you don't have a healthy sense of humor, certainly, and a large degree of how much luck's involved, I think the job can wear you out and make your life miserable. So, I mean, there's days I think I'm a pretty laid back guy. There's days when my head's about to explode and I'm just so angry. How did I take this guy over that guy? God, I missed this opportunity, missed that opportunity. But I think we often use the term like informed mistakes. We put a lot of time and effort in every decision. It's the right one. Only time will tell. But if we feel like we put enough work in behind it and the process is you know, well-oiled and well-intentioned, you know, you can live with mistakes. You're not happy with them. You got to reconstruct the crime and figure out why we messed up. But my having all those jobs, and when I first got into the NBA, I had other jobs too. So I never wanted it not to be fun. I got in the NBA to have fun, and regardless of what my role was, I never wanted to be that guy that could make such a magical game, such a cool game, a game that brings so much joy to, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. I didn't want to treat it as if I was, you know, selling wallpaper. So that works 99% of the time. Then 1% of the time, you want to go on a long walk and just say, curse yourself out. Like, how can you be so stupid to take this guy instead of that guy? Or you didn't do this trade. But I think the sense of humor and the kind of the realization of how little effect a lot of these things are going to have makes it an easier job, and oftentimes makes us a little more naturally aggressive because we're not scared of failure.
He may go down as, you know, the best player you've drafted, Nikola Jokic, who you took at 41 overall in the draft. I imagine you wish you had some romantic story to tell everybody about when you saw him. You just knew this guy is going to be a franchise player. He's going to be an all-star. What did you see when you saw him?
Yeah, we were so smart. He was our third pick in that draft. We were just playing possum. You know, what we saw, we've had some success in the second round with European guys. We took that first draft. We took Joffrey Laverne, mm-hmm. turned into a really good player, and had actually the same agent, which was helpful during the process of getting a call over here. So the second round is a complete crapshoot. The reality is most second round picks don't make it. We try to find one or two attributes that allow them to make it, whether it's size and skill, athleticism. We put a huge emphasis, probably even in the second round in particular, is he a great kid? As a second round pick, you have to be a great kid, unless you're just so supremely talented that 30 teams missed on you and you fell for some reason. And, you know, but for the most part, the guys who make it certainly are talented and skilled, but if they're not great kids, because you come in, the league expects you to fail. Front offices, coaches, when you're a second round pick, it's very hard to ever be taken seriously. So with Nikola, we saw the guy from a basketball family. Both of his brothers played. One played at Detroit and then CW Post. Another important factor in European guys is, does he want to play here? There's guys who don't hold the NBA as their be-all and end-all. He had a girlfriend who was in the States going to college, so there was already a connectivity to the U.S. He'd like to play in the NBA. And we saw a 6'10" guy that could really pass and had a very kind of funky way of being effective. That Hoop Summit, I mean, we have half the Hoop Summit team now with Lyles and Moutier and Jokic and Murray. He was able to be successful against higher level athletes in a very atypical manner. Like, his body still is not Adonis like. He's really worked hard on that. But at that age, he had a frumpy body, almost a softball player's body. But, you know, he's scoring under guys' arms and he's ball faking. And we saw all that. You know, this guy's a chance. The first glimpse we saw of him being more than just, hey, this guy's got a chance. And we also looked at his productivity and his style of play versus other European bigs who have made it in the last 10 years. So we watch tape of him at the same age versus Gortat, him at tape at the same age versus Gasol. I mean, the Gasol story is amazing. You know, trying to find, is there any one thing that allowed all these guys to make it, who were kind of second tier European players at the time of the draft? So we did all that. We rolled the dice. We took them. The first, I think, indication we had they could be more than, hey, this guy's, we thought he played in the NBA when we drafted him. We took Nurkic in the first at 16. We thought, you know, Nurkic, Jokic potentially could be a pretty good 1-2 combo at the five. Jokic is certainly much more finesse. He's a step away guy, and Nurk's so good around the paint. He's such a physical guy. His first game the following season, the year after we drafted him, the Adriatic League, I'll make the numbers up, but I think it's like a 28-14-6. And we watched it. It was an impressive game. I mean, a couple of the passes he had were passes you generally don't see, much less from a center. So that was probably the first indicator. But anyone looking for some brilliant story where one guy came in and said, I found him, they'll be sorely disappointed. It was, you know, a couple of us liked him. Then, like we always do, we challenge our whole staff to look at him, challenge the original thought. If you don't like him, speak loudly. We had a lot of good discussions. There was a couple other guys in the second round we really liked. When our board went up, we didn't think they'd be there at 41. So we were aggressive to try to lock a guy like that in. But his story is amazing. I mean, it's fascinating, and I think it could not happen to a nicer person. So I've joked with him a lot recently. So don't get a big head. Don't get a big head. I don't think the kid doesn't even know what a big head means. If we win and he has 0 points and 11 assists, he's the happiest guy in the world. You know, he had 40 in the Garden on Friday night. It was the Garden on Friday night's always great. After the game, he was just sitting there like he had 10-6 in a D-League game. He was completely oblivious to what that meant. He's like, I played pretty well. I probably could have had more. But that his approach is what makes him even more lovable, because he just tries to play the right way and the numbers are there great. If we win, that's all that matters.
Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process, but SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and they'll let you know if ticket prices fall. And even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to bamboozle you with big fees on the checkout page. Now listen closely to this next part, because it's a real important part of the process. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $20 right into your pocket. And to get it, all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, then enter promo code WOJ. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So please support SeatGeek the way they support us here at the WOJ Pod. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WOJ today. Support for the WOJ Pod comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time and make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/woj. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Was there a moment, or has there been a moment in time where you said to yourself, or you talked among the staff and say, every decision we make now with the Nuggets is based around, does that decision fit around Jokic? Has that point come?
Yeah, I think not every, because I think there is a point where you can become so style specific. Mm-hmm. God forbid there's an injury and we have 14 guys who only function off of Nikola. So you need a couple guys who play in a different fashion. But this draft was interesting. We got to our second first round pick, Tyler Lydon. We had some guys pretty high on the board. Could he play with Nikola Jokic? And that's, you know, if the answer is no, or we think it's a no, it's tough to add guys to your team that can't play with a guy that's going to be a foundational piece for the next 10 years. And the way Nikola plays, almost anyone can play with him. It's more, how do we surround him with guys that kind of, you know, overly ball dominant guys are probably not great for us right now. But if you're that good and you're that good an ISO player, there's still a huge benefit to that because, you know, the last 2 minutes of basketball, it's not always flow basketball. It's not, you know, dribble handing off. So I think it's a fine line where, look, the guy who's most quickly figured out how to play off Nikola is Gary. Gary's an unbelievable cutter. I mean, he shoot 50% from the field last year as a 6'4", 2 guard. He's unbelievably impressive. He's an excellent shooter. He and Nikola have unbelievable chemistry. I mean, they don't even have to look at each other to know what they're going to do. So we saw the success Gary had, and when we're looking at to acquire players, who has a high IQ, who can make quick plays, who can understand that we're playing an atypical style of basketball. We're going to have a 5-4 will probably lead our team in assist, which is uncommon in the NBA. But I do think there's a line, though, where you can't have all these guys. And how do you also get guys to protect them? I think, you know, Nicole's not the most athletic guy. So with guys like Plumlee or Fareed, their athleticism are extremely necessary because, you know, our Paul and Nikola, good athletes, but not vertical athletes, not way above the rim guys. So how not do you just compliment them, but to protect them as well?
Is it a difficult thing to judge when you see a guy with great skill, but without athleticism, without some of the physical attributes, and how is it going to translate into this NBA? Can he make these plays he's making here when he's in the NBA? To me, I wonder if it's almost like when a baseball scout sees like a pitcher who doesn't hit 97, 98 on the gun, but he's getting people out in the high 80s.
Hey, Jamie Moyer.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think it's the hardest thing. And I'm the first, I mean, I'm a sucker for skill, and I can put too much like the pretty basketball, the guys that outsmart bigger, more athletic guys. And I've been wrong in a lot of cases thinking these guys can make it. You know, the athleticism and just the size and strength of the NBA guys, it's, you know, it's pretty impressive. So it's very difficult. I think it's become such a skill league lately where I think right now we're in a weird place where 1996, 97, I'm in the draft room. If you were a tweener, it was a kiss of death. Now if you're a tweener, you're the most coveted thing in the NBA. If you're a 3-4 and can make a shot, you're a coveted asset. You don't have to handle, you don't have to play make. If you can do those two things, where I think it was harder all around in the NBA, you know, 10, 15 years ago, because you had to be nice, you know. Now, as these coaches have become so good and so smart and the styles become so specific, you can be a really high-level player and get paid a lot of money doing one or two things. So the evolution of the NBA to a more skill-centric league, I think it's not as physical as it once was, certainly. There's numerous examples of guys that don't look the part generally or don't have 38-inch verticals, aren't plus-7 wingspans, who are really, really good NBA players. And I don't know if that would have been the case, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But I think it's a little easier now to say he has this level of talent and maybe he's not the greatest athlete, but his skill set is such that he can overcome the deficiencies athletically than it was 5-10 years ago. But it's still really hard because you don't know until you get out there with these NBA guys. These guys are all so talented. They're all so gifted. It's, you know, so much is rolled. You don't know anything until you get on a regular season NBA game and see how a kid reacts against, you know, the best players in the world.
Yusuf Nurkic, Mason Plumlee. The trade you made with Portland last year, to me, was a really unique trade in this NBA in that it was really just a basketball trade. We were trading the same position, both young players, and we kind of feel like the other fits better with the group we have because almost every deal in the NBA now is based on money, getting money off, or I'm going to lose a guy and I got to get assets for him. It is hard for me to go back and think of many deals that were just that, a basketball trade, which I imagine when you were in Washington and young and got into the league, that was a kind of deal that happened all the time.
It is frustrating now where so many leagues don't have basketball in mind. that part, it can make deal making challenging. That was we had well publicized issues with, as Nicola started to take off. Yuka, who's a great kid, was struggling with his new role. It was no secret league-wide. We thought a guy like Mason, with his ability to play with and without Nicola, with his physicality, with his team-first approach, might be a good fit. Certainly, it's been fantastic for Yuka to have that starting opportunity. He played great. I don't think anyone ever questioned Yuka's talent or skill set, and we're extremely happy to have Mason. But there is very few calls you can make or take where it's, hey, you know what, we have too many small forwards and you got a good power forward, or hey, this guy's a good player, that part's frustrating, even in that regard. During the Nurkic conversations, kind of realizing a change of scenery would be good for both the player and the team, how few willing partners there were, even teams on paper at least. Hey, we think this guy's a starting center. He's proven to be such. Certainly, you could be the first to tell you he probably handles some things differently. He's an immature kid at the time, and emotionally, you never know how you're going to deal with things, but he's a good kid and a very good player. I was shocked, to your original point, when you make these calls, the teams think, hey, they really need a center. Man, oh, this team can't rebound a lick. This would be an easy one. And how rarely the basketball is the focus of the conversation. Well, he's got another year, or I heard this. And maybe I'm overly simplistic in looking at it. I just think, well, you need a center, and he's a great rebounder. It seems to make sense, but it has become almost too many casts in the league. And, you know, this team doesn't care, and they're trying to tank, and this team won't move it because they're too good, and this team has financial issues. Very rarely to say, this team is a two-guard, and we have three two-guards, and, you know, we need a backup power forward. I think that has changed dramatically as some of the approaches to building teams has changed.
Is it different than when you first got on trade calls, even, you know, when you started making calls in this league? Was that a more common, that kind of position for position, this guy can help us and your guy can help me? Were those more common calls, or has this been the case for a long time?
I can't say for certain because I wasn't privy to those calls, yeah, you know, my whole career. But I can say for certain that, at least in my strong opinion, it's become a bit too cloak and dagger, a bit too, I'm going to lead with this topic, but I really want to get this guy. Our approach has always been to be pretty forthright and, hey, we like that. Would you trade this player? I don't see the value in, you know, you have to have a degree of being coy and being cool in deal making, but I don't see any value in when I make a call and I'm trying to misdirect to get to what I really want to. So when we call, Artoris, myself, anybody on staff, we like player X. Would you trade player X? Who do you like? I think there's been a lot of books on negotiations read in our league and really, really bright guys, and their approach has certainly works, but our approach is a little more straight and direct. We need to move this guy because we have too many players this position, or we just got an injury at a point guard. We need that guy. We need a veteran. We're very, very transparent when we get on these calls, hoping to expedite the process, because it can get, you know, some of these calls can get a bit tedious, and what takes one call takes five calls, and that's not, I don't think, good for anybody.
Give me an example of the trade conversation that you hate. Like, what does it start with?
I mean, I like everybody. Like, they're all, the other guys, the other 29 guys are all good guys. They all have different approaches. Hate's probably a strong word, but I just like being direct. I like the ones when they say, well, we're going to talk to our group. or and we all have used that, so I'm sure, yeah, I've used that before. Or I'm not saying I would do this, but, and we all have to say that too because we're not owners, right? But I don't like any conversation that is purposely like disingenuous, hoping to get somewhere else. We might do this, we might do this, and then we would do this. Well, that could have been achieved the first 5 minutes of the conversation. Anything, our time is, there's so much going on. When guys can get to the point pretty quickly and guys can be honest, I think the lion's share of our league is very honest. They're all really good guys. And there's a million different ways to approach those calls, but I'd like to be, the league knows who you're going to trade too, for the most part. They know who's available. So they can look at your roster, say, I think he's available, or they're trying to move him for that reason. So when you make those calls, the ones I hate, here's one. When you get good intel, oftentimes from that team, and then you call the guy, oh, no, we wouldn't move him. And you kind of want to say, well, your assistant GM told me that he's a guy you potentially would move. I mean, you know, I'm not making up this call. Those ones can be challenging a little bit because we all know. I mean, you can look at the roster and you can look at guys potentially on the outside looking in, guys that teams will be willing to have conversations about. But for the most part, they're all fun. There's a lot of really smart guys in these chairs and they're all good guys. But for us, the more direct, the quicker, the better.
What's the fastest trade you ever put together?
I don't know. I made a trade on an airplane once, texting. It was right before the trade deadline, and I told the guy I was going to be out of pocket. And you know, he calls me right as like, turn your phone off. So
right.
Got on Southwest Wi-Fi and got a trade done. I don't know. We like to move quickly, if at all possible. The trade market's fascinating. Like you said, it's you never know how to read it. It can be really hot, and then it can disappear. And I think there's so much really smart media right now, you know, present company not included, where I think it's really affecting how willing guys are to trade. They're scared to death of how the blogosphere is going to judge them. And I really think that's going to have a negative impact on trade. I firmly believe that the fear of the initial assessment is preventing teams from making trades right now. You should make it, but what's good for your team? That's all that matters, right? It's not about value. It's not a perceived value. Those things have to be part and parcel of your analysis. But are you a better team when you make a trade? That should be the ultimate indicator of the trade's successful. And I think as the media's got, you know, much more well-informed, there's just so many smart media guys that know the CBA, you know advanced analytics inside and out. I think that's hurt deal-making.
Well, because it used to be, well, this is a results-oriented business, but people can be lauded for creating future cap space. They can be lauded for getting money off. There's lots of other things you can be credited with and get a positive reaction versus does that help them win games, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's teams that have had tons of success over the last couple of years, and you're regularly kind of beat up by national media. And there's teams that are going through rebuilds and have got some good young players, and they're kind of the darlings of the media. So, and also, quite frankly, 10, 15 years ago, the media didn't know as much. They couldn't pull up the PER of this player as that player. They didn't know, or they didn't want to know what the cap situation is going to be in 3 years from now. So I think it's a compliment to the media, but it's also, again, what should matter is your owner happy? Is your coach happy? Is your team better? That's what should matter, ultimately. And I think way too often, that's the last thing that matters with these rapid fire. Like, I think it's great. Draft day grades. I think it's fantastic. You'll know you had a good draft 3 years from now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and
what grade did you get for Nikola Jokic? And
I know, and, right, I like, know your network didn't show him. I know it was a commercial. And we were largely criticized for Nikola Jokic. You know, oh, another overseas guy. We're not going to see all those things. And there's nothing wrong with it because, look, I'm a fan. I'm a Baltimore Ravens fan. I like to read what the smart guys, who's the guy from ESPN, long time.
Mel Kiper.
I love it. I think he's great. And he's got the McShay.
Tom McShay. Yeah.
These guys are fantastic. I read them like I'm sure someone reads Gavoni. I think it's fantastic. It's really interesting. But it certainly drives clicks. It drives readership. But to grade a draft on draft night is the most laughable thing ever.
I agree with that. And you know, a very good general manager said to me a couple of years ago that he felt in the league it had become, my process is better than your process. Results don't matter anymore.
I agree. I totally agree. I think it's people are too laudatory. Is that a word?
It is.
Of the smart.
That's a Fordham word.
Yeah, it's not a Catholic word. Of the process, what's the result? You can. I laugh a lot at college basketball, for example. I used to go to Jim Boeheim's practice a lot. Jim Boeheim is not the strictest disciplinarian. I mean, the last time I went to practice, I get track and field, and I've been concurrently going on this before the new facility. Students are walking through. Jim Boeheim has been an unbelievably successful college coach. He does it his way. You know? So I think you have to do it your own way, and how you frame your process has become way too, I think, indicative of how successfully be viewed. And that's the process is hugely important to us. It's something that we bang on every day. Process, because you can't control, we can't be results driven solely because we can't control results. But if you're successful, you're successful. Whether you're successful with a 5-person staff or you're successful with a 20-person staff, whether you're successful based with a hugely analytic a model or you're just old school basketball guys. Success is success is success. And I do agree with you. I think too often the prettier it is, the cooler it sounds, then with that comes more adulation.
Tim, this was a lot of fun, man. I'm glad we did it again.
Yeah, that was fun. Thanks for coming out. Should be a fun year, so hopefully you can get back out. Malone's doing a great job. I think we're going to have a fun style of basketball this year, and it'll be fun to watch these young guys get better. And I don't know, maybe we'll do a playoff edition.
There you go. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to my guest today, Denver Nuggets president Tim Connolly. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of this podcast. You can find us on Apple Pods or wherever else you get your shows. You can also hear the Woj Pod every Wednesday and Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to thank today's sponsors, SeatGeek and ZipRecruiter. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Woj Pod. We'll catch you next time.